Welcome on to a Wednesday night edition of the show. Got a lot of news to catch up with here, and then we're going to hit something that was a good question on the little impromptu solo Twitter NBA show that I did last night about which teams have the best young cores going forward. So, of course, we will parse that down into great detail, including arguing over what exactly a young core even means here. But let's start, Danny. Dylan Murphy and I discussed this to some degree. We've discussed it in other forums. But anything you wanted to add on the sad news of Jimmy Butler undergoing surgery on his right meniscus over last weekend?
Well, we're going to get a much better sense of what this means for the Timberwolves as a team. But the schedule part of this is fascinating because they just happen to have a bunch of games against good teams and a bunch of games against bad teams. And so the bad ones, they should be able to win either way. But what we'll decide...
Unless it's on the road in the Eastern Conference.
Yeah, we'll have to see where the rubber meets the road there again. But considering how hard it looks like the teams in the 9 and 10 spots right now, that's actually technically the Nuggets and the Jazz, but, you know, all the teams in that range are pushing, it's going to be a stronger race to get in. I still think they're going to make it at this moment. That's how I'm feeling about it. But it also, I think the biggest impact that we're going to see if they still make it in is that this totally changes the dynamic with the 1 and 2 seeds if you believe that Jimmy Butler is going to come back and be ready for a theoretical first round series, because if they are the 7 or the 8, they have a much higher ceiling than anybody else with Jimmy Butler that could be in those spots.
So right now the predictions at 538, which assume that the Wolves will play as they have with Jimmy Butler all season, assume that they're to finish it with a 48-34 record. The Wolves currently 38-26. 10 teams, of course, are in the race, and with all of those teams playing so well, and with all of the teams out of the playoffs, really in tank mode now in both conferences, you have to imagine that these teams at the bottom are going to continue to play well. As you mentioned, they're pushing them. So the Jazz and Nuggets are currently projected to be out of the playoffs as of now, but to still get to 44 wins. So the Wolves already have 38. It's difficult to imagine. I mean, they've got 18 games left right now. As long as they go better than 6-12 over their last 18 games, I think they'll be in decent shape. That'll get to 45 wins. It's hard to imagine that 45 wins won't get you in. Some possibility that Butler could return as well before then. And Dylan and I talked a little bit about how, or at least I talked at him. He didn't really respond to it because he was doing more of the X's and O's stuff about what it's going to look like without Butler. But the long-term impact for Butler returning 4 to 6 weeks, a very short timeline. Of course, all of the things are being said about how this is a minor repair. It's or a minor surgery. It's not a full repair. There's not a large amount of the meniscus being removed, et cetera, et cetera. He's 28 right now, hits free agency at 29 next offseason. But you always just wonder about guys coming back so quickly from these meniscus surgeries. And it seems like more times than not, there are complications that cause it. But there are a few where there haven't been, right? Like Kevin Love last year, Derrick Rose in 2015. You know, those are ones where the guys were able to come back and look like themselves pretty much in the playoffs, but there are just as many times where the guys either weren't the same or pushed back and weren't quite the guy. Either weren't the same going forward ever or weren't quite ready to play.
That is certainly the more important point long-term, just because, you know, I think both sides would hope that this can be a long-term relationship and you want to make sure that Butler is the best that he can be moving forward. And Minnesota beat the Kings. It got into single digits in the fourth quarter, but they ended up winning by, I think it was 18. But I want to rattle quickly
and just
through.
Winning these first two.
Yeah.
Just winning these first two without Butler, granted against bad teams, were important against the Bulls and Kings.
Yeah, they are important because that changed it from being 8 wins that they needed to 6. You know, that is a good line here. But so the next stretch is going to be brutal. At Portland, at Utah, back-to-back. Boston, Golden State, at Washington, at San Antonio, Houston, and then what could be a swing game with the Clippers. So you have the psychological effects of that as well. They could absolutely win one or more of those games, but let's say for the sake of discussion that they do not, then this looks different at that point than it does right now. And they'll have a lot of games against winnable teams. I mean, Memphis, Atlanta, Dallas, that type of game a lot more later than just the way their schedule breaks out. But, you know, it's for certain teams, it's like, oh, it can feel like a tailspin, especially if it takes place over 2 weeks or so. So I still expect them to be in, but that structure, and because we know they're going to be within all of those games without Jimmy Butler, that will be harder. But They just have to do it. And I think they're still going to make it in, but the 7 or 8 seed is absolutely a possibility. I haven't gone through everybody else's to see if they have these types of stretches, but it's going to be a challenge.
Also, they have enough shot creation on this team that if Butler comes back to the playoffs and he's not 100%, it's possible for him to just kind of focus on defense and not be as big a part of shot creation. And you still got Teague, you still got Wiggins, you still got Towns, you still got Crawford, et cetera, et cetera. Still got Shabazz Muhammad, just kidding. Who actually looks like is not going to get bought out as far as we know. He had wanted a buyout, he had wanted a trade, wasn't getting it. He's got a player option for next year, see how much of that he's willing to give back. But if he's not going to play at all, you'd imagine they could do better just trying to get some other guys in their system who could be part of their future, because they really don't need the shot creation that he brings unless like three more guys go down. Out of Colorado,
They've been starting Bielitsa in both of the first two games the extra spot. So Bielitsa, Towns, and Taj Gibson all together, they don't really have a clean option at the three. That's just how this team is structured, because those guys are hard to get and they didn't use their remaining assets to do it. Is that the best option? Part of me thinks that it might be, just because there isn't really anybody else.
Yeah. I think that's probably right. I mean, you got to have him. He guards whoever of the two or three. Wiggins isn't guarding. Wiggins has to take the best threat now. They still haven't, to my knowledge, gone to any lineups with Teague and Jones together. They could do that a little bit with some backup units, you would think. I don't really know who else it's supposed to be at this point outside of Bielitsa, unless it's Crawford. And Crawford was likely going to be closing some games, you would imagine. But I think you don't want him starting Bielitsa is still probably better defensively than Crawford is, at least has a little bit more size. Anything else on that?
No.
So as I started to transition to some sad news out of Aspen, Colorado, where a longtime NBA agent Dan Fagan was killed in a car crash. He's had a ton of clients in his career, really one of the most powerful agents of the last 20 years. DeMarcus Cousins, John Wall, Ricky Rubio, Chandler Parsons, Dwight Howard at one point, DeAndre Jordan at one point. And Fagan certainly has a complicated legacy in NBA circles with some of the things that his clients went through, such as Dwight getting out of Orlando and DeAndre Jordan turning back from the Mavericks. Parsons, a guy whose contract situations have had a ton of drama as well. And then he had his own issues with a company that bought his practice and then alleged that he was not performing to that agreement. But certainly a guy who, well known as an extremely tough negotiator, there was an outpouring of support both from his former clients and even his competitors and league executives of sadness at his passing.
I mean, he had been an absolute force in the league, negotiated some of the biggest and, you know, most significant contracts in this recent era. I mean, especially since you and I have been covering the league. And another part of this is just, agents, sometimes their role is very, very big news. Other times it's a lot behind the scenes. And so he's somebody who has connections with really anybody that you know in the league. I mean, we've seen this with players, certainly with general managers and writers alike. And so it's a shame to see him gone and to have his influence gone forever from the league.
Yeah, I mean, certainly having him involved in some negotiations made it interesting. And I know a lot of people in the league, if he wasn't the number one guy you didn't want to cross from you in a negotiation, he was right up there. And usually that is a good thing for your client. In San Antonio, Mike Wright and Woj reporting that Kawhi Leonard has returned to the Spurs facility. He had been working out in New York and has hopes of returning to the lineup sometime in March. I'm not sure how to reconcile this with some of Popovich's statements that he doesn't expect him to return this year. Maybe that's simply lowering expectations. Maybe that was supposed to be a kick in the pants to Leonard. It seems like if so, that has worked, although who knows whether this is a change from what Leonard's previous plans were. There is no indication from Kawhi's camp that he wasn't working to get back by any means, but working to get back and that he will return. I mean, this has been such an intractable injury for him with this quad tendon that if he's not feeling right, you have to imagine he's not necessarily going to try and push through it when he doesn't feel comfortable. And of course, I don't blame him for that in the slightest.
I am now officially in wait and see mode with all this kind of stuff. Of course, we absolutely can and must report it because it's important for us. But from my own expectations, when I see him on the court for a game, I will be thrilled and relieved that he is back, and I will not deal with the ups and downs of it, because I'm just at this point, like with the way that it's gone, I'm just I don't know I I, don't think I'm in the right place for it in that way. So I want to see him back. Want to see him back as soon as is responsible for him. But, you know, if it for whatever reason it's not this year, then it's not this year.
About a week ago, Zach Lowe reported that the NBA, for the first time, is seriously considering some kind of a play-in tournament among certain lower seeds. I think the way he had it was the most commonly conceived version was seeds 7 through 10 would be in a play-in tournament with some pretty big advantages for the 7 and 8 seed to get in, but 9 and 10 would have a chance to get into the playoffs. What are your thoughts on that? These are the sort of big issues that you enjoy thinking about.
One big concern for me is timing. I mean, no matter how you want to do that, if it's going to be multiple teams, then it's going to take a little bit of time. And I'm sure certain points rest is good, but you have to worry about the rest versus rust element of it. But the biggest thing for me is it devalues the regular season to a point. I mean, it is an accomplishment. It is true that the best teams don't always make it in. And so I'm happy that the NBA is reportedly considering changes. I think that's a healthy league is always considering what other ideas can make them better and considering the better ones more stringently than the other ones. So that part of it I do really like. But for me, ideas more like having the top seeds be able to choose their opponents, which is a material advantage for being at the top and just has greater benefits, encourages the right things, and doesn't create all the other logistical stuff. I think that is more in line. But hey, if they want to consider whatever they want to do, by all means. And if they can figure out the thorny elements of it, I don't have that much opposition to this. I think my opposition is more making it a tournament rather than the kind of the equivalent of a play-in game, that sort of thing.
Yeah, it might be nice, and the exact details elude me, and I'm sure that they're not really nailed down yet. A couple of reasons why I like it. And do you remember how crappy and anticlimactic the last couple days of the season were last year when some of the teams that were playing, like Miami, for instance, like with the Bulls trying to get in, they were just playing against tanking Brooklyn, and the Bulls won by like 40 points against them. I think when you compare the last couple of years, the race to the bottom for lottery seeding position has actually been more interesting than the race for the playoffs in these last couple of games. And oddly enough, I could just note it from our numbers. Usually we really lock in on all of those games the last 3-4 days of the season. And those are some of our lowest rated episodes of the year talking about those games, which is pretty remarkable. So it doesn't seem like that much interest is there right now in the chase for the 7 and 8 seeds. And this could change that. There's also some hope that tanking would be curbed to some degree just by the potential of now that you're moving the possibility of at least getting into this tournament, making it to the 10th seed. And so that'll take a few more tankers out, especially when you consider too that with the lottery change coming up, that kind of middle ground where you could be the 10th seed in a conference might actually matter in terms of like you could get into lottery position. So they don't want to, I think the tanking inflection point is going to be lowered now to kind of, you know, the 5 through 10 range, as opposed to being one of the worst teams in the league. So I think it's a good idea. I'm glad that it's being discussed. I mean, change for the sake of change is dumb, like the moving the extra point back and just adding more randomness to a kicker's skill for no reason in the NFL is like one of the dumbest rule changes I've ever heard of. But this doesn't fall into that category. Change for change sake is not great, but I think I would be more interested personally in the last week before the playoffs if this tournament were going on than if it were just the end of the regular season. And also if they wanted to cut off a little bit of the regular season as well, that wouldn't be the end of the world to me either.
Yeah, I've been an ardent supporter of that for a long time. I think they should reduce that in other ways. One other, it's funny how you get colored by the recent experience, but to me, one of the most definitive last days of the season in the last few years was that race for the 8th seed and that New Orleans San Antonio game, which had these massive ramifications.
Oh, yeah.
If you
great.
Change the incentives here, then that sort of game doesn't happen too. So it goes both ways. And I want to be...
Wait, why wouldn't that game happen? That was a game to see like who was going to... Oh, I guess the New Orleans
had right.
to get
Yeah, New Orleans had to win.
But there's also enough advantage to being 7 and 8 in this that you're going to be trying really hard. Because I think what it is it's like... I thought the formula was like 7 and 8 play. The winner of that one is in. And then 9 and 10 play.
The loser of 7 and 8 plays.
The winner of that plays the loser of 7 and 8. So you still have a big time advantage. And you're going to play at home in that game against the winner of 9 and 10. So there's still a pretty big advantage there.
Yeah, it is. But I mean, the randomness of one game, of course, is different. Though, of course, you could argue that New Orleans in that one. It was the randomness of one game there too. So yeah, I mean it's fine. I think if they could combine it with the other stuff like choosing your opponents, because it could lead to better teams being in. And also the other potential thing here is it could impact the trade deadline. I mean, think about who's in the 9 and 10 spots. So in the West, it's all these teams. We just talked about that with Minnesota.
Yeah, we might see. You think we see fewer trades or would we see more trades?
I think in years like this where that we would see fewer trades because teams, you know, Kemba Walker, that type of thing. But there are other years where the sellers are a little bit worse or a little bit better, and then that could shift it. So I think generally you'd see a little bit more. This is kind of a strange apportioning of talent where it just so happened that, like, the, you know, and then the Pistons ended up being big buyers. They would probably be big buyers in this hypothetical either way.
Yeah, I think that it's really, you're creating more buyers in theory by giving more teams a chance at making the playoffs, or at least the pseudo playoffs. Also, tangentially related to this, Adam Silver, in the wake of Mark Cuban's $600,000 fine, releasing a memo basically saying, yeah, okay, you know what, like, if you want to, over the course of many years, try to rebuild your team, that's all legitimate, that's all okay, but if we have any indication that you're actually trying to lose games, I think maybe even there was a suggestion in Tim McMahon and Brian Windhorst's piece that some teams might even use analytics to give coaches an indication of which lineups would be really bad, that if there's any indication like that of, like, real specifically trying to lose games in the moment, that the league will come down in the hardest possible terms. Ironic, I thought that Silver made the point about, oh, it's legitimate to rebuild, when, you know, by a lot of accounts, he was influential in getting Sam Hinkie run out of town. And I've always, my feeling has always been, I find it much less abhorrent to do what the Sixers did than just the, oh, we're going to shut down, like, the good players who are on our team now and not play them. I mean, what the Bulls are doing with Robin Lopez and Justin Holiday is completely ridiculous. And if you are doing stuff, you know, once you already have your team, to make your team worse and try and lose games, that to me is much more abhorrent than, all right, you know, we're going to try and cycle through and find some young players and take on bad money and do it in more of a, but, you know, try to win games with the personnel that we have on the roster as best we can. I kind of agree with what Silver is saying here, but it's also ironic that the one person ever really faced any, I wouldn't say discipline, but negative consequences, which the league was somewhat involved with, was in fact the Sixers, who really, there was no allegation at all that they were intentionally trying to lose games down the end of the season. They just were bad and designed their team that way.
It's also kind of frustrating in the sense that it doesn't affect the schedule at this point. I mean, the schedule is incredibly complicated, and we need to, you know, the way of all the constraints of the buildings and everything like that. But understanding the way that the league is right now, a team, and there are certain examples of this that are coming up, facing an opponent twice in the last week or two of the season can be a material competitive advantage or disadvantage based on how this is. And it would, if it's possible, I think one of the design constraints on the computer, or however they input all this information and do it, should be minimizing the repeat games that you have in the last month or so of the season and trying to balance that part of it out, because it can be, you know, we're seeing how close these playoff races are going to be, both for seeding and also just to make it in, that it can be material in this case.
All right, we got to do some quick injury news here before we get into talking about the young cores. But first, this from a new sponsor, Lending Club. For me, this is a service that I wish it had been around when I was younger. They give you access to low rates on loans of up to $40,000 for almost any purpose, whether it's taking control of your debt, making home improvements, unexpected repairs, medical expenses. For me, when I was in my 20s, for various reasons, whether it was car repairs at one point, it was medical expenses at one point, it was credit card debt at another point, in part because of those first two things, I went to my bank and I looked into getting a personal loan to consolidate my credit card debt, which of course was an astronomical interest rate. And the process was just an utter pain in the butt. I couldn't get the loan, didn't like the interest rate. Lending Club is much easier than going to a bank, and they offer lower rates than high interest credit cards. What you do is you go to lendingclub.com, enter the amount of money you need, and you can see if you're approved in just minutes. And there are a number of different offers and payment plans over different amounts of time, and the money could be in your account just days later. To get your loan through Lending Club, or just check it out, this isn't going to affect your credit at all, by the way, go to lendingclub.com/capspace to check your rate for free. Once again, it won't impact your credit score. That is lendingclub.com/capspace. All loans made by WebBank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. That's lendingclub.com/capspace. Let them know that you came from us. While I was doing that read, I got a call on my cell phone. Has this happened to you where you get a call from a number that is like very close to your own number. And like, it like at first it caused me to pick it up. I was like, oh, wow, this must be like something local. It's like one number off from my number. And then of course it was just some spam call.
I thought we were going into some sort of new ad read there. Yes, I have.
It's just a funny tactic. I'm like, ooh, this person must be similar to me.
I've gotten really frustrated that getting the, now that spam calls are more frequently coming in from your own area code, even just that part of it, is because at first it used to be like,
yeah, well, it's all
right,
just spoofing,
right. And so it used to be that if you saw something like that, you'd be like, oh, okay, you know. And if it was from some random place across the country that you didn't know, you'd be like, okay, but now it's, you know, it can go all over. But that's exactly why they wanted that technology, because it made people more likely to pick up the phone. So it's frustrating. But let's get to injuries. I think the ones that I'm interested in, I guess, first is the Clippers, because the Clippers are competing in this. Gallinari has a hand injury. He's missed the last couple games, including their win in Denver that we talked about last night. And then Avery Bradley is going to be out for a while, and there are concerns that this will require offseason surgery with the same groin injury that he had, you know, going into the deadline in the first place.
Yeah, Doc Rivers' comments were not encouraging. It sounds like an indefinite absence for Bradley, and there's been some reporting that it's a sports hernia, which is, you know, kind of related to the groin. Rivers saying, hey, you know, he's an on-ball defender. He's got to move his feet. Like, that's all core stuff, and he's absolutely right about that. And with Bradley's free agency impending, you have to wonder about whether he could eventually just have surgery now or get shut down. The Suns claiming that this year we're not going to tank. Jay Triano noting that shutting down Eric Bledsoe was a big reason why he was so disgruntled, and perhaps they got less in trade for him than they might have, or they could have actually, you know, kept him around and tried to win some games this year. So they claim they're not going to do that. But with Bledsoe gone, I mean, really the only two guys who you would look at as veteran shutdown candidates are Tyson Chandler, who's dealing with a sore neck right now and has been missing some games, and of course Jared Dudley. So it's not like they have all these guys that they're going to shut down anyway. So I don't think it's really going to matter. And you know, they've been playing all their best players, and they've still been plenty bad this season anyway. I mean, maybe they'll look a little bit better with Elfrid Payton, but it's looking like that is
something
unlikely.
I'm going to kind of keep an eye on. Not accusing them of any malfeasance, but we've seen a couple games already of these teams that are in the bottom eight going out to leads and then losing those leads promptly. Like, you know, like the Magic went up, I think, 8 on OKC because they were hitting every shot and then lost. I'm not saying those teams are tanking, but it is interesting how, other than that one Mavericks win against the Pacers, I believe, gravity has always fallen in the same direction. But that is what you would expect with bad teams.
Nice story out of New Orleans. Emeka Okafor has signed for the rest of the season. He's actually been starting, getting the Keith Bogans, but just to save Anthony Davis's ego that he doesn't have to actually start at center, although ironically he's probably costing himself a chance at first team All-NBA by not doing that, although he's going to play so many minutes at center now that he'll probably be in that conversation. That'll be really interesting to see whether he or Joel Embiid ends up getting first team All-NBA if we continue on the same path. But good for Okafor to get back. I mean, he had such a mysterious injury. I mean, it's been so long since he's played that you have to go back to 2013 when that injury popped up, and then the Wizards trading a first round pick to the Suns for Marcin Gortat to replace him. I mean, that's the last time he had played in the NBA, and he really worked his way back through the G League and has been able to give New Orleans at least some decently effective minutes. Quick hitters injury wise, Cody Zeller experienced some soreness in that surgically repaired left knee. He did not return from their game on Monday. I believe it was against the Bulls. Dwight Howard had a sore back, but is supposed to play tonight, Wednesday night, which we're recording before. That's a concern for Zeller. We'll have to monitor that. I mean, he definitely, whether it's bone bruise, swelling, surgery, seems to really suffer from some of these nagging issues. And when you have swelling in the same knee that was repaired, that's never a good sign. But one good sign for the Mavericks is Nerlens Noel will be available tonight, Wednesday night, to play for the first time. He is apparently will not be bought out because this is the last day to do that before you can sign with a contender. You don't have to sign prior to March 1st, but you must be bought out by March 1st. And then you can sign up until the last day of the regular season and still play in the playoffs. And speaking of buyouts, Corey Brewer's getting one.
He is. And there has been some speculation that I've seen that he could reunite with college coach, and this gives me great pain as a UCLA alum, Billy Donovan, to do that. And I think that would be a poor use of resources for the Thunder. I don't think he gives, like, he's not a part of a playoff rotation, and that's really the line for them because they want to not only...
Well...
Right, exactly. That's why I think it would be a mistake. I'm not just... It's not an objective truth, but yeah.
I agree with you. I mean, I think he really is... they definitely need something on the wing, and Brewer is a vet. Donovan, of course, has the familiarity with him. You can very... I mean, this smacks of years ago, the Thunder signing guys like Derek Fisher and Caron Butler, who really were not able to contribute much anymore back in the Kevin Durant era, and then playing them over a potentially superior option as well. And so, I think playing Brewer over an Alex Abrines, I think Abrines is just way better than Brewer is. Just Brewer's inability to shoot it, and his defense has always been massively overrated. So if you're getting him just as insurance as a good vet, all right, I get that. But the fear is that he's going to play, and if they do sign him, my prediction will be that he will be a part of the playoff rotation, and that would be to the Thunder detriment.
A couple other just real quick injury things. Aaron Gordon is playing, but he's not all the way, still dealing with some hip stuff. And Jonathan Isaac is not returning just yet. He played for the Lakeland Magic. We talked about that a little bit on the 15 and 60. And then I believe I saw that Terrence Ross had a little bit of a setback, so he's still a little while away from returning. And when you're a little while away at this point, that means we might not see much of you the rest of the season.
Yeah, especially on a team that wouldn't mind keeping their draft pick. And for Gordon, this is something to monitor too. Remember, he's on a schedule for restricted free agency, and this is an injury that happened before the All-Star break. He had missed nearly a month of time here and there, and then came back. He's still apparently experiencing some pain. So if that's going to be the case, I'm not sure whether a surgical intervention would be required here or whether it's just going to be rest, but he's someone who could in theory be a shutdown candidate as well. And frankly, considering the fact that so much of his value this year has been in shooting that we believe is unsustainable, might actually be a good idea, unless he can really beat this pretty quickly. And we still haven't seen who's going to get waived in Philadelphia yet. Maybe that'll come down pretty quickly here. They are reportedly going to sign Ersan Ilyasova. Trevor Booker did not play last night against Miami. They went with Rashawn Holmes in a too big alignment instead of Booker, and so that maybe could augur that it would be Booker. They did trade a first round or a second round pick for him, obviously, in addition to Okafor and Stauskas. Not that those guys had any value, and they've proved that in Brooklyn so far, but for the front office to give up a second rounder and then move on from Booker would not be the greatest in terms of public relations, but I think would in fact be the right. So let's talk about these young cores, and the criteria that we decided to use. Young core is a term that's thrown around a lot. Oh, these guys have a great young core. They have the best young cores. That's what, of course, inspired the question, which was a good one. I would give credit to the viewer who did it, but I'm sorry, I don't remember as of this point. But so where we went on this was a little different definition of the young part of young core, age 25 season or younger. And I think that's where you can still hope that these guys are going to get a little bit better, even if, for the prospects list, we do 23. But we're talking about, for that, guys that we expect to still get a lot better when you're 23. But if you're 25 and you're going to be under team control for a while, then I think it's reasonable to include that, 25 through 28. They may not be young by the end of it, but we're kind of thinking about the question of, can you see these guys being the core of a good team in 3 years? And so then we also generally, unless there were certain extenuating circumstances, wanted to limit it to guys who are under team control, either via their current contract or via restricted free agency for the next three seasons after this one. But again, in a few extenuating circumstances, we made exceptions. And anything else you want to say on just kind of like what your methodology was here, Danny?
The only thing I'll add is there is a question with some of these teams, specifically the ones that have already been established, in terms of whether those players are key on their team. I think one of the differences between the two of us is that I like to think about it in the abstract. The Celtics are probably the example. I might as well just get out and say
sure.
It. Because those players are not the entirety of the core of their current team. But the way I thought about it, because I thought it was more intellectually interesting, is what if they were the core of their own team? And so if they didn't have the surrounding talent like Al Horford and Gordon Hayward, who don't qualify. And that made it a more interesting for me. So since it was more interesting, I rolled with it.
Yeah, and you convinced me on that when we were talking earlier today about it. It seemed like I wanted to go in another direction of like, oh, they have to be the core right now. But I think it's more, would they be the core of the team in 3 years. So to me, there were six teams that really were in consideration. The Celtics, Kyrie Irving, still his age 25 season. Jaylen Brown, Jason Tatum would be the main guys. You could throw Terry Rozier, Marcus Smart in there as well, as guys who are at least established rotation players at this point. I'm not sure that Rozier or Smart are really going to be starters. I mean, that was kind of the threshold for me, is guys that you look at as like, okay, these are going to be surefire quality starters. I'm not sure you could say that about Irving, Brown, anyone other than Irving, Brown, and Tatum among their young guys. But they have some other guys that maybe, you know, some outs who could hit there. Celtics on the list for you?
Oh, absolutely. And they're probably high on the list for me. And we're not considering draft picks at all because that's not fair. But the Celtics also do have draft assets that could theoretically be added to this core, or they could take some of those assets and throw it to Anthony Davis, who I don't think would qualify for this list now. Is this his age 25 year or 26? Do you remember?
He is, as of right now. Oh no, my friend. He doesn't even turn 25 until March 11th.
Ridiculous. Oh, I should have known that because I included him on the Pelicans list. I should have remembered that, but I didn't scroll down.
But nonetheless, since he's the only guy who's even remotely, it's really hard to have the Pels in this, especially when you consider just that they really seem to have stagnated so badly. I mean, that like one guy isn't really what the spirit of the question is about to me.
So I was thinking it'd be interesting to just go breeze a little bit through some of the ones that we didn't think of as top tier but are still notable.
Well, let's get the ones that we are talking
about. Sure.
I think the way I want to do this is let's do the ones that we think are really in consideration first, and then at the end, because once we've established, hey, this is what the threshold is, I think it's a lot easier to say, well, you know, you're not meeting it here. I mean, and we'll see whether, at least to objective fans, these are at all controversial omissions. But as I mentioned, I had six. One was the Celtics, the Denver Nuggets, Nikola Jokic, Jamal Murray, Gary Harris are the three who really stick out. You could also maybe throw Trey Lyles in there as well. And they have some limitations. We'll discuss all these teams more in greater detail. So Nuggets on the list for you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you have star talent, you have starter talent, and then Lyles is an intriguing bench player who really does provide value for them. And also, with Nuggets, this isn't a consideration for me, but I wanted to mention that all of their guys, even if you expand it to Malik Beasley and Wancho, they're all 23 and younger. So these are really young core guys, which is great, and that's a benefit.
And frankly, I mean, you know, they've got Will Barton. Yeah, they've got Wilson Chandler, who's started to play a little bit better lately.
Millsap.
They've got Plumlee. Yeah, although Millsap has barely played this year. So the point that I was making is they're a team that's been over 500 this year with your three best players, essentially, or maybe three most important. You know, you can argue about whether Murray has been better than maybe Barton this year, but your three most important players, three most important starters, all 23 or younger, to be this good is rare. I mean, and you know, that's why it was so rare when that OKC team actually made the finals in 2012 with, I think, if they weren't all 23 or younger, Harden, Westbrook, and Durant. I mean, I don't know that we'll ever really see anything like that again in NBA history. It's absolutely crazy. So Nuggets definitely on that list to me, although I think they do have some structural limitations going forward that could limit their ceiling. The Milwaukee Bucks, although Chris Middleton and Eric Bledsoe are probably two of their three best players now, they still have a nice looking core going forward. Giannis Antetokounmpo, who is the best player right now of anybody who we're considering among this young core group. And then Jabari Parker looking better in this analysis since he's come back, and at least offensively has looked pretty decent. And then it gets a little dicier if you're talking about guys who are going to be, you know, looking like high level of starters. Maybe Malcolm Brogdon gets there. Thon Maker, I'm not willing to totally give up hope, but certainly, you know, he's got a long way to go. And they have a few more outs there too, with like a Sterling Brown. And I did appreciate your inclusion of Marshall Plumlee on the list. Is Marshall Plumlee even under 25?
This is his age 25 season
question.
I almost thought about putting a question mark around Thon Maker, but I'm saving those jokes for other times.
Okay, so Bucks obviously on the list for you, right?
Oh, of course.
The Wolves are an interesting one, because you would think, okay, core, that means at least three guys. Well, they only have three guys that really even fall into this category. Towns and Wiggins, for sure, obviously, those guys are starters, although when one of the guys is, when the guys in question are not, have a player in Butler who's clearly better than either of them, you know, you definitely have to get a demerit there because he's been the one carrying them to winning basketball. And then Tyus Jones is the other one. You know, I'm not sure that I see Tyus Jones as a starter. Maybe he could be a lower end starter at some point. But you know, not a lot of depth with those Wolves. They do have the top end talent with Towns, and then obviously Wiggins is one of the more controversial players in the NBA. Wolves on their few?
Yeah, I mean, the strength at the top end is really important there. And I really like Tyus Jones. I think Tyus Jones can be a part, a significant part of their success, whether it's as a starter or as a backup. So I think he does help their case. And when you look at a lot of these third guys, you know, he's accomplished in a different way. And I like the way he fits with the other two, which is not a major consideration, but it is something I thought about because if guys conflict, then they provide less value as a core together.
Who else did you have that you viewed as a reasonable contender in this analysis?
I mean, the Sixers are just massive in this. The unquestionable ones are Joel Embiid, Ben Simmons, and Dario Saric. Those guys are all established at this point to their own degree. Markel Fultz, we both had as the number one guy in his class. There are still a lot of question marks. He is obviously not established at this point. And then on the fringes, TJ McConnell and TLC. I mean, TLC is on the fringe of mentioning here just because I think I don't expect him to be a starter. And then McConnell is a value backup. I mean, if we're including Tyus Jones, including McConnell is certainly fair. And I mean, you have star talent there. You have depth. You have guys, especially the top two, that already fit together well, which is shocking considering this is their first season playing together. And so, yeah, they are high in the conversation. They're not just in it.
Obviously, Sixers there for me too. Did you have the Lakers?
Yeah, I had the Lakers as the kind of the last team in that. And it's not, I mean, though, of course, the people who listen to the Top Prospects pod are still giving a shit about that for our own independent decisions on it. But the combination of Ingram, Ball, Kuzma, Josh Hart, and then you can make arguments that other players should be, but they don't really have either the team control or just everything else with Randall. KCP, they only have non-bird rights. He would qualify, which is amazing just by how young he is. And then their centers aren't good. Zubac and Bryan aren't good enough right now to really make it into this core conversation. So, but yeah, I think they deserve consideration because they have serious potential. They, you know, I think Kuzma's been better this year than I expected, and Ingram too. He's really made some strides with the ball in his hands now. So I had them as my last team in, but I did have them in.
Yeah, I did it as well. I mean, and we could talk more about them. You know, maybe I don't know if they're going to be last among the six in the ultimate analysis. I didn't think there was really anybody else close enough at this point to merit inclusion, although there certainly are some teams that are bad and have some young players, but they're either don't quite have the depth, don't quite have the star power, or just are too early on in the rebuild. So we'll take a second here and then we'll come back and figure out who we think has the best young core in the NBA. After this from Wink, I have not really been a huge wine drinker, but certainly living in the Bay Area, I do plenty of it. And of course, I was generally just reduced to going to the liquor store and seeing which labels looked the prettiest and was within my budget and just picking one out and going to a party and hoping that, because that's what you're supposed to bring to a party, right, is wine. Just hoping that I had actually picked out a decent bottle. And usually people were nice enough to say that it was good, but who knows whether they're actually telling the truth or not. However, my sister is someone who definitely can be trusted to tell the truth. She is a Duncan after all, and isn't really super into sparing people's feelings when it comes to beverage choices, because she's worked in the service industry for a long time, knows everything there is to know about beverages. And so I was worried when she came to visit over Christmas, what am I going to do to get a decent bottle of wine here that's not going to be a massive disappointment? And then I realized, oh yeah, I've got these bottles from Wink. And so we opened up a great white from Wonderful Wine Company. This is their white wine blend. And she was really impressed. She's like, wow, this is good. Like, where'd you get this? And I told her, and she was totally impressed. So if you want to impress your skeptical family members, if you want to really enjoy some wine, but you don't know a ton about wine, you can use their palate profile quiz. That's what enabled me to get this wine that I really enjoyed. They'll ask you questions like how you take coffee, how you feel about blueberries, and they'll send you wines curated to your taste. The more wines that you can rate, the more personalized your monthly selections get over time. They have a ton of wines that you can't get anywhere else. There's no membership fees. You could skip any month and you can cancel anytime. Best of all, they're really a believer in their wine personalization. They cover the shipping, and then if you don't like a bottle, they'll replace it with one that you will like. So the way to get started with them is TryWink, TryWinc.com/capspace. They'll get you $20 off your first shipment. TryWink, TryWinc.com/capspace. Easy to remember that /capspace URL to get that $20 off, because we talk about capspace here all the time on the program. TryWinc.com/capspace. So if we're going to talk about it, the number one slot here, what I'm really trying to think about is, all right, if you take all these guys in 3 years, and then you try to fill in with a normal team and normal resources around them, who's going to make the core of the best team? And so what was the answer to that question for you out of those teams that we discussed?
I ended up with the Sixers. They have a really nice balance. You have a guy in Ben Simmons who can handle the ball, who can do a lot of the high leverage things that you need on that end. Joel Embiid is still my defensive player of the year pick, despite this being his first full year of basketball, which is unbelievable to be at that level at this point. Sure, there are injury risks and all that. And then Šarić has, we talked about this in the 15 and 60, he's really impressed as fitting with that group. And maybe depending on who they get long term, he becomes more of a super sub, but he has been a good starter for them. There's no reason to believe that he should be anything less than that for them. Fultz is still a high upside play, incredibly talented guy. His handle is unimpeachable. He just needs a jump shot to be valid. And so they have this nice balance. The team that was actually the closest for me, and I didn't expect this going in, partially because I didn't really realize this was Kyrie's age 25 season, is the Celtics. Because what the Celtics have that is incredibly valuable is two players on the wing that fit together. And so it's a lot easier to build with that group than almost all of the other combinations. You have those two. That means you can get a center, dime a dozen right now, not a big deal. You don't have to get somebody perfect, though they have a really good guy in Horford. And then you probably want to get a two. I'm thinking that's probably the way you'd want to do it. And of the 2, 3, 4, that's probably the easiest guy to get along with what they already have. You could even just get another three if the guy can shoot. So those were 1 and 2 for me, which is ludicrous because those two teams actually have more draft assets than a lot of the other teams on this list.
Yeah, some might carp at the inclusion of Irving, who's only actually under contract for one more year, but considering that he is really having an actualized season in Boston, that he engineered a trade to Boston, that Boston will be able to offer him more years and more money than anybody else when he becomes a free agent, and that they are looking like they're a pretty successful team. I'm willing to give them the benefit of the doubt here that you can count on him being there. I mean, you never know, obviously, but I feel pretty good about that compared to a lot of these free agent decisions, especially since the Celtics are looking like, you know, they're going to be right up there in the East this whole time. It's a very difficult decision for me between the Sixers and the Celtics, in part for some of the reasons that we've discussed lately about the Sixers just being such an extreme, odd team in this day and age. And with Simmons and Bede, even Šarić, like guys who have very extreme strengths and weaknesses. And while you have, and Robert Covington, while he's a little too old to be on this list, he should be around during this period still. You can think of him as maybe part of this, but it's very difficult for me to know how this team is going to be in the playoffs because we've seen that the best teams of recent vintage have been built around great players on the wing who can attack off the dribble, who can also shoot, great point guard play at times, and a lot of shooting. And this is your top three guys, it looks like, who are not going to be, none of them are amazing shooters. I mean, Embiid, he'll take some threes, but that's not his role. Šarić is hitting okay, but he's not like, you know, just some absolute bomber type guy. He's more of a versatile player. And obviously Simmons has those massive limitations. I do believe even with Markelle Fultz, even if it's less likely that his upside will now be realized, he still does have that upside to me. And so maybe you could say these guys have the highest upside. And then you can also, though, if you're going to change the Celtics, Irving is the most prototypical of this group in terms of the type of player that's been really successful leading teams of late. And he's been to the finals. He's been great in the finals already, which no one else really in this discussion can say. But Brown, Tatum, you know, I'm not sure how much I believe it in their shooting. Those other guys, Rozier and Smart, you know, not really a major part of this to me. I don't see them as high level starters going forward. And while Brown and Tatum physically are the type of guys on the wing that you struggle to acquire, and as you mentioned, it's kind of easier to fill around them, I guess I might go with the Celtics as a little bit better.
I'll explain the huge thing here for me. The difference is defense, because I think that what you need around the Sixers is you need shooting and capable ball handling from guys that are guard sized. That is possible to do. You know, you're not maybe going to get perfect players because we're assuming equal assets. We're not assuming they get what the Sixers do with the full max spot and a lottery pick this year, all that kind of stuff. The ability to have like one of those truly rare centers that can probably stay on the floor against these teams that affects the game every time he's there, that is a lot different. Like when we did the center rankings podcast, podcast, talked about how the guys, once you fell out of the top 10, they didn't really provide a ton of value. But those guys, especially in the top five, really, really do, because they're miles away, and we'll need to see him beat in the playoffs. But the idea of the margin between him and whatever that theoretical Celtics core could have, because they don't get Horford in this hypothetical, what they could have around them, I think that margin is really, really significant.
Yeah, and for me, it's just more that I'm just not sure that a big 7'2 center and then your other best player who can't shoot outside of 3 feet is going to work in the playoffs. It's just too unorthodox. Maybe it will. Why are the Bucks not in this to you? And Giannis, by far to me, is the best player of any of these guys.
Because of the rest of it. I mean, Giannis is definitely the best of those guys. And also, he gets the benefit more than Kyrie. I mean, you could say, hey, Kyrie, you know, he's had a wonderful, wonderful career to this point. But Giannis will get better, I would say, when you think about how young he still is, which is insane. But Jabari, Brogdon, Thon, those guys aren't really at the same caliber. I mean, they can be support players, but I don't think they can really step up. I mean, Ben Simmons is on the fringe of the All-NBA conversation this year. Like, that is a very different level than where Jabari Parker has ever been.
Yeah. If Jabari just didn't suck so badly on defense, it would be, and obviously the health issues too, but if he just weren't a complete sieve defensively, I would just feel so much better about where this Bucks team was. But I agree with you. I have a great deal of skepticism, both health and defense, and from a making his teammates better standpoint, even on offense, I think, you know, we believe in his scoring, but, you know, in him as a second option, then Brogdon, Maker. I mean, Maker does, I still feel like, have a fair amount of upside to be a good starter, but the question is about his age, the lack of improvement this year, the strength issues that he's
inconsistency
had,
is a big issue
not
too.
Not very explosive. And, yeah, right. And so much depends on the Bucks too, of just like what ends up happening with their coaching situation going forward as well. I mean, if they can get a great coach in there and then really fill in the right talent around these guys, we might feel very differently about all of these players in the future. But as of right now, I think it's difficult to me. And yeah, I mean, Simmons is just, despite his limitations, so much better of a number two than Jabari is. And, you know, Jabari, Jalen versus Jalen Brown, Jason Tatum. But Tatum, by the way, really fallen off in the last couple of months with his shooting, as we expected, but he's shooting like 32% from three, I think, in the last couple of months. I'm just not enough of a believer in Jabari to put the Bucks in this conversation. They just don't have
one
the depth.
That I found really hard, because it's just choosing which thing you value, was between the Bucks and the Nuggets, because the Bucks have the better top guy. I mean, Giannis is better right now as a two-way, like kind of as an overall impact, than I expect Jokic to be. And Jokic is fabulous. I love him, but he's just not. Giannis is, you know, I had him as my MVP for the year through January. I don't think he'll be there for February, but he's at that level at this point. I don't think Jokic is going to be there. But Jamal Murray and Gary Harris are both higher, significantly higher rung to me than Jabari, Brogdon, those type of guys. So it's kind of, do you value the MVP candidate more than you value the two rock solid starters ideally? And maybe Jamal has more potential than that. Or do you value the true star?
This isn't quite there, but if you had to, because we're including things other than just this core, but if you had to say, all right, over the next 5 years, which team, the Bucks or the Nuggets, is going to have the highest win total in an individual season, I would go with the Bucks. I think pretty clearly over the Nuggets. I think the Bucks, like, just because they have Giannis and just like not a bunch of total clowns around him, like they should be, I think they're going to win 50 games. I'm not sure that the Nuggets can get there because they have some massive structural issues here. I mean, Jokic, Harris is, you know, I think he's overrated as an individual defender. He gets steals, but not someone you look at as really like a lockdown guy. And he's also just a two guard anyway. He doesn't have the size to guard the best wing guys. They don't have anyone on this team, even now, and certainly not in this core, who can guard the best wings on the other team. And Murray has gotten better this year defensively, but he's still a sieve. Jokic is awful. You know, I know that he has like good RPM numbers, but I mean, he's just too slow moving out on the court, especially when you get into the playoffs, it's going to be a disaster. Trey Lyles is awful defensively as well. So this core has nobody in it who can really defend it. So I don't see how this Nuggets team would ever get to the level defensively where they're going to be a solid 50-win team, unless they make, you know, a real big addition. And maybe they'll look a lot better with Millsap in. I'm not sure that's going to be the case. But especially if we're just talking about the core, I think they just have too many limitations. And then what they still need to get, solid 3 and D contributors, and then you you still have a center who is not going to be good defensively, and that might still be fatal to you anyway. That's why I have the Nuggets, I think, a little bit lower, even though I like all their pieces individually. I kind of wish I could trade one of the, like, you know, Jamal Murray for Jaylen Brown or Jason Tatum instead, even though, you know, I might even like Murray as much or more than those guys at this point. But just the fit issues, I think, are massive.
The other component of this, which is important, and you alluded to it a little bit, but what you need around those guys. I mean, you need forwards that can defend and ideally can still shoot credibly. Great. So does everybody else. Whereas with the Bucks, it's more like the Sixers, where what they need is more doable. And they also have some intriguing kind of upside pieces. Brogdon, I think, can fit in certain elements with Giannis, at least a part of the rotation. And Thon, you know, he could be a potential solution. There's a chance of it. So they have kind of better lottery ticket guys in that than the Nuggets do. So I went that way as well. But I just found it an interesting intellectual exercise. And I had the Nuggets over the Wolves for that reason. Because I like the ancillary stuff. I think Towns is better than Jokic. I've had him above him in the, you know, in the prospect rankings. I think there's more of a ceiling, especially defensively, if he ever does get it. Whether he does or not is an open question for now. But Jamal Murray and Gary Harris have, you know, they have a lot more offensive capability. I think I can see their place in that. And Wiggins hasn't been good enough defensively to make me think, oh, well, he could do that. You know, he has the physical capability, but he hasn't shown it.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, if Wiggins really could become a contributor on both ends and a guy who could hit shots, then I might feel a lot differently. But yeah, you know, it's really tough to say between the Wolves and the Nuggets. I agree with you that Towns is better than anyone in that Nuggets core, but, you know, I think Wiggins is one of the most overrated players, I should say, at this point. And the Nuggets have a lot more flexibility. I mean, this is not really part of this, but just in general, they have more flexibility to get better than the Wolves do. Where are we on the Lakers right now? You know, Ingram has had a nice month of February. Lonzo, not really sure what to think about him at this point. He's just coming back. He's almost had a lost year due to injuries. He has these shooting issues. Kuzma, who we were high on, really has kind of fallen off. And he's looking more like kind of a scoring backup forward than a guy you're looking at as a future star. I've liked what I've seen from Josh Hart, who just broke his hand today. And I think he can be a guy at the two who can play up a little bit more defensively, hit shots, although I'd like to see him take more shots than he has. I'm not sure whether to include Julius Randle. We normally would for a guy who's a restricted free agent, but because of the fact that they may be trying to clear some more cap space with him this summer, I'm not sure whether to include him or not as aggressively as we might. I think really what this comes down to, though, is what do you think of Lonzo Ball and what do you think of Brandon Ingram?
My concern with the Lakers is that they have a lot of guys that are more in the kind of 4-7 range on a good team than players who are at the 1-3, and we know that is essential for building a successful team. You need a best player. You know, there's a reason why the teams that we had at the top all have these linchpin type guys, and Ingram has been good this year. What I want to see from him the rest of the season is, okay, if you have the ball in his hands, it certainly activates him a little bit more, but there is a threshold test that isn't relevant to the Lakers this year because they aren't good enough for this, which is, can he be a part of an offense that is actually good, that can compete against good teams, or is it just the best use of him? And with Lonzo Ball, it's the same type of thing. If he can't get his jump shot all the way around,
yeah,
because being better with the ball in your hands doesn't mean you're good enough to propel a team, and that's the difference between Giannis and Ingram at this point. Giannis has proven that. Brandon Ingram has not.
Yeah, and for Ingram, you know, certainly I think he's made strides this year. The defense in particular, I think he's been a big part of this team that has defended well. I think that Lonzo can be a solid defensive player, maybe not a lockdown guy, but a guy who can be a quality help defender from the guard slot. You know, I'm not really giving that much juice to Kuzma or Hart in this because you really, to be in this conversation, you have to have the top end talent. I mean, and if you're just going to compare, and Lonzo, we know what his shooting struggles have been. Even if you want to say he gets to start shooting it better, you know, he still has a ton of limitations running pick and roll, getting to the rim, finishing, getting to the foul line, actually making a free throw. All of those, he's got a very, very long way to go there. I mean, and so if you're just going to compare Brandon Ingram and Lonzo Ball to Nikola Jokic and Jamal Murray and Gary Harris, I mean, I think there's really, even though those guys are not that good defensively as of right now, I mean, those guys are not that much older than Ingram and Ball, and they're just so much more accomplished. You know, I mean, I don't see Ingram or Ball playing at an all NBA type of level the way we see from Nikola Jokic. You know, there's nobody, I think, anywhere near the upside of Giannis or Towns Cousins or Embiid or Simmons in there. And yeah, like I said, Ingram has looked better this year. They put the ball in his hands more. I still remain skeptical of whether he's going to be worthy of that. He's not that athletic. He's not that shifty. He's not that good of a shooter. He's not that good of a passer. Defensively, I think he's solid and he can switch, but he's not just an all-encompassing force doing things like protecting the basket. His steal and block rates are still very low. He never gets a rebound given his physical tools. And, you know, he's made some strides, but the Lakers hype machine is still completely out of control for him. And if you just, he's one of these guys where if you didn't know that he was listed as having a 7'3 wingspan, like how much lower would the hype on him be, right? But he just still doesn't do enough with that wingspan. Like he gets graded on this curve where it's like, oh, he's doing all this stuff and he has this wingspan. So it's like somehow more impressive that he's doing what he's doing because you just assume he has this wingspan. And so the sky is going to be the limit for him. Whereas, you know, I'm not really sure that there's evidence for that at this point. You know, I think he's going to be a solid young player. I think he could be a solid starter. Maybe he could be the second best player on a pretty good team. You know, that's what I see more of his upside. And that's if he reaches that upside. So I just, his upside is much lower to me than just the top end guys that we're talking about here. And the same thing with Lonzo Ball with all the limitations he has.
After this conversation, I think it's been clarifying. I'm moving them into kind of a separate tier because there are some other teams that we haven't mentioned that have really intriguing cores. And so I was thinking about, let's say, the Indiana Pacers. So the Pacers, Oladipo still counts. So he, yeah, you know, all-star, potential all-NBA guy. Miles Turner, talented, imperfect, you know, all that kind of stuff. Sabonis is a valuable piece. I mean, there's a little bit of duplication and certainly not positional valuation with that. And then, you know, some lottery tickets, TJ Leaf, Ike Anabogu, and then GR3 is probably not considered because he's an unrestricted free agent this summer.
Yeah, and you know, he hasn't, like, actually done anything in his career. That could be a reason, too.
He has physical talent. And then the other team that I think we should talk about when we're having this conversation, because of their top two, is the Utah Jazz. Donovan Mitchell, Rudy Gobert in either order. I mean, Mitchell is more the rising guy. Gobert, you know, a phenomenal talent. And I think he gets the Kyrie Irving penalty where he's been kind of at this level for such a long time that he gets hurt being a member of a young core where, because we think of it as like the guys that are rising rather than the guys that have already.
But he's ascended. Under contract for three more years.
Oh, yeah. He certainly qualifies. So. And then their support pieces are Royce O'Neal and then Exum. I mean, they're going to have the rights on him if they want to. They can figure that out. So, I mean, so I was sitting there going like, okay, I think those two teams are at the bare minimum in the mix with the Lakers. And especially, I mean, Oladipo right now, he's done more than I would say a lot of the potential outcomes on Brandon Ingram. And I'm higher on Ingram than I was back when we did the prospect rankings. Just Oladipo this year has been fabulous.
Yeah, you know what? Like, I agree with you. Like, I think I would move the Pacers and it's different types of things too. You know, I mean, both the Pacers guys and the Jazz guys, even Mitchell, who's a little older, are more fully formed than, you know, Ingram, Lonzo Ball, 20 and 19 respectively. So, but if you wanted to say, hey, would I rather have Donovan Mitchell and Rudy Gobert, or would I rather have Brandon Ingram and Lonzo Ball for the rest of their careers? Like, no contest. I would rather have Mitchell and Gobert. And then, you know, yeah, they don't have the depth behind those guys, but I don't think that Kyle Kuzma and Josh Hart are closing that gap. And even for the Pacers, there's still some skepticism about Oladipo. You did some research on how his shot has fallen off, particularly from three. We'll see how much longer he can keep this up. The Pacers actually are on a little bit of a losing skid right now. Turner is another guy that I've kind of been skeptical of, but yeah, still, even with the way Oladipo has played so far this year, you know, I think it's very possible that neither Brandon Ingram nor Lonzo Ball ever has as good of a season as Victor Oladipo is having right now for the Pacers.
They're not really at this level, but one team I want to mention just because it's such an unusual group is Toronto. So Toronto has an OG Anunoby, Jakob Poeltl, and Valanciunas. Both those guys, Valanciunas is still, this is age 25 year, Van Vliet, Siakam, Powell, and DeLon Wright. That, just in terms of depth, like, that's almost a freaking team. It's not a great team, but it's almost a team. And I mean, we talked about how their second unit has been wonderful this year, and I just admire the strength of that. And you have all those guys that I think are capable rotation players and under team control, so they all qualify.
Yeah, I mean, they just don't have the top end talent. I mean, there's a lot of great role players on,
yeah, that's why I wanted to mention it, but not, they're not in this group.
Yeah, well, I think we can kind of wrap up here. Let's do our final rankings here among like the top 7 seven or eight, and then we can talk about some of these other, you know, barely receiving votes teams. So your number one is the Sixers?
Yeah, I'll just rattle them off. Sixers, Celtics, Bucks, Nuggets, Wolves, Jazz, Pacers, Lakers. And those teams are all really, really close. And yeah, that's all.
Yeah, I'm pretty close there. I think I'd go with the Celtics just barely ahead of the Sixers. Bucks third, just because Giannis is so good. I would have the Wolves ahead of the Nuggets, just because I still think that it's a little bit too hard to build around those guys if you're keeping all of them as a core. And I think the Wolves have a little bit more top-end talent. I think we might be sleeping a little bit too much on the Jazz. It's just, it's hard to, when you, it's only two people to really call it a core, but you could certainly make the argument that like Donovan Mitchell and Rudy Gobert is more valuable than having the three Nuggets guys. I mean, that's an interesting question too, of like, you know, is Gobert better than Jokic? We ranked him, I think both of us higher than Jokic, although Jokic is younger. I do think Jamal Murray still has just a crap load of upside as an offensive player. You know, someone asked me what his upside is, and I've always said, like, I think he's like Steph Light is his upside. I mean, he's never going to get to that level. I don't know if anyone in NBA history ever will, to reach the heights that Steph Curry has as just, you know, a pure shooter. But I think Murray has the ability maybe to be kind of the closest thing we've seen to him. I don't think he's going to get there, but yeah, I think he has the possibility to get there. So it's but if we're really, you know, talking about not just upside, but I think that Jazz group has some more certainty, and they're going to defend as well. So if we're not going to penalize too much for depth, you know, I might even have the Jazz, and I'm sorry I didn't mention them early on. So maybe I bet all those Utah fans just turned this off already in anger. Liam has probably like burned his computer already, actually, or hopefully just his phone if he's listening to the podcast on his phone. But yeah, I might even have the Jazz as high as fifth above the Nuggets, but I would have the Nuggets substantially above Pacers or Lakers, and Lakers would probably be whatever that is, seventh or eighth to me. Any reaction to what I just said before we talk about a few of these other teams?
Not really. I mean, it was close for me, but just the depth of the Nuggets is interesting, and Trey Lyles is just as another supportive piece, and Royce O'Neal, we shouldn't just completely dismiss him. He has shown some nice little flashes defensively, but again, more of a rotation guy than a starter, obviously.
Right. So of all the teams we mentioned or haven't mentioned yet, who do you think has like the biggest gripe of being, you know, left out, or who would you rank as the next highest out of this group, maybe is a better way to put that? Because I know who's going to have the biggest gripe. It just won't be justified. That's Suns fans and the cult of Devin Booker.
They'll definitely have the biggest gripe. And adding Elfrid Payton does really help them, even though he's imperfect, but just having a point guard option, because that was one of the flaws with them. And the other guys who qualify for reference, TJ Warren, Josh Jackson, Bender, Marquise Chris, how much enthusiasm you have for them. So they do have this like kind of depth of lottery ticket guys, but they're just not established in the same way. And Devin Booker, he's a scorer. Sure. Absolutely. I still am not sold on him as an offensive force, as a player who can elevate even superior talent to what he has right now, but just by virtue of being out there, that he can prove that. He will hopefully have the opportunity to do that in the future, but he just has not done it yet. But he is among kind of, so you're looking at one of the big differences between them, and like, so he's not nearly as established as Kristaps Porzingis. Porzingis, if the ACL tear hadn't happened, I think that actually materially affected the Knicks part of this for me.
Yeah.
Because Frank Nilkina, Tim Hardaway Jr., and then Cameron Moutier both are age appropriate, but just have their different elements of it there. But we don't know what Porzingis we're going to see from this point. I mean, it is massively concerning, and he's also out for a year. So you have that element of it. But yeah, I think the Suns will have the biggest gripe. And I guess
I disagree with that. I think the Suns, to me,
they will have it. I'm not saying they deserve it.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right, yeah. Because to me, I mean, the Suns is just like, all right, you take all these guys, and 3 years from now, you just keep this team together. I don't see even like a 500 team there.
There isn't a defensive identity for sure. And their offense, I mean,
many things can be an identity. It doesn't have to be positive. I think I know what I would have their identity be defensively.
Josh Jackson, TJ Warren, limitations as shooters. TJ Warren, wonderful scorer, but has that stuff. Elfrid Payton doesn't exactly fuel that fire in any positive way. And then Bender and Chris, you know, they have their moments, they have their values, but they're not there. So then who do you think does have the most legitimate gripe?
Well, let me just go through the list here. So the Mavs, really only Dennis Smith Jr. is the one you can say Harrison Barnes can be a free agent after next year. Nobody else really that sexy in that group. The Nets, guess you could look at D'Angelo Russell, Spencer Dinwiddie, Jared Allen, Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, LeVert, Allen Crabbe. Amazingly, Allen Crabbe is still that young. But don't see the top-end talent with those guys. I think it's an interesting question of whether you'd rather have those guys or the Bulls guys. Markkanen, Levine, and Chris Dunn are really the only ones that I would put in that category as guys I look at as like potential future starters. But, you know, I'm not sure that either of those teams, if you look at it, a lot of it to me would depend on like how good Jared Allen could be defensively. Can he be one of those guys who's going to be like a solid, you know, make a solid defense on his own? You know, hasn't been doing that this year. We've seen how bad they've been defensively lately, but he's obviously a rookie. Let's see, who else are we talking? I mean, the Magic, we just don't know what Jonathan Isaac in particular are going to be, and Evan Fournier and Gordon. You know, I mean, I don't see those guys just getting like so much better. You know, that's another one of those teams where you're like, all right, keep this guys together, and they'll just never even be like a 500 team. The Kings, just way too limited at this point, and some of those guys are older in this analysis already. They're pretty close to fully formed. Gosh, you know what? Like, I mean, if you wanted to just say, like, if you just kept these guys together and they were the best guys on their team 3 years from now, you might just say the Raptors, just because you know, like, they're going to defend and they'll be able to hit shots, you know, and you can hopefully just fill in around them with some, like, instant offense guys here and there and actually have, like, a decent enough team that you know is going to defend and play hard and cause problems for people.
I was waiting for you to mention the Heat on almost exactly the same rationale.
Yeah.
Josh Richardson, Bam Adebayo, Justice Winslow, and Tyler Johnson. That group isn't going to score, but they're going to defend the ever-loving crap out of every team.
Yeah, they just don't. That Heat group doesn't have enough shooting. That's the problem,
I think.
Whereas I think that
I agree with you. I think they're a step down from the Raptors, but I would heartily enjoy having that group of guys for the next little while.
But yeah, I mean, if you're making me pick one of these with a gun to my head, gosh, I don't know. Really tough to say. I mean, there's just so many guys who aren't fully formed, who are massive defensive liabilities. I mean, worth noting here that none of this later group that we're talking about has anything approaching like a solid, really like two-way wing player in the group.
Tim Hardaway Jr. doesn't qualify?
Yeah.
Though that does tie in for me. I think the Knicks deserve serious consideration for this just because Porzingis at his best has been incredible. Yeah. I mean, he's been better than any other player that is not in that top tier. And
yeah, Nillekin is so far away though, man.
He is. And if he doesn't do it offensively, think about what you need from another. You need somebody who can run a lot of pick and roll. You need somebody who can do the offense. But I mean, Porzingis is enough. I mean, he's enough to get in the conversation in a way that I think Suns fans probably feel Devin Booker is, but Devin Booker is not Kristaps Porzingis.
Yeah, even the Pistons, I mean, at this level with Drummond, Kennard, Stanley Johnson, the last name that you put here that I'm not going to say. all right, I think we're scraping the bottom of the barrel here. So this was fun, though. I'm glad we did this. I'm glad that question.
Oh, I have one more question. Cool. Did you have one because I compiled the lists for every team. Was there one that you thought, oh my God, like that's the worst? Oh, where would you put the Pelicans here just because they have Anthony Davis?
Oh, well, I mean, basically AD by himself is, you know, getting you a 40 to 45 win.
I might honestly take him over the Raptors, as much as I like all those guys, because it's Anthony.
Oh, sure. No, of course you would.
So then they're next. He's carrying Shaikh Diallo and Frank Jackson all the way.
But yeah, that said, I like that really evades the spirit of the question.
Sure.
I think even when with some of the like the Jazz is almost kind of doing that, where when he's really, again, when you say core, you really mean three people, you know. So it's kind of fudging it even with two for the Jazz. So I think you can't really say that because you're like, oh man, there's this young core. We're so excited about these players. Plural.
So in terms of an apple
core can be singular, right? Like,
yeah. So briefly, in terms of the worst, I mean, the team for me, and this will obviously improve with the draft, is probably Memphis. I mean, they have a lot of Dylan Brooks, Wayne Selden, like type of guys that I don't expect to be starters on a good team. And they don't have other guys really beyond that. It's just a bunch of big man lottery tickets that don't look like they're going
to
pan out.
Yeah, that's it's tough to argue with that. All right, that'll do it. Thanks so much for sticking around for this. This is a fun little exercise here. We'll be back tomorrow night with gamers on the Thursday night games to close out the week. Don't forget about our sponsors, Wink. Try wink.com/catspace. Could use $20 off your first order and you can take their palate quiz, get some wine that you're actually going to enjoy, and we'll impress discerning other people in your life as well. Talk to you all tomorrow night.